We are live from the stand, and joining us on the program right now is retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel George Hardy, one of the original Tuskegee Airmen. And Colonel Hardy, a pleasure to have you with us this morning. We certainly appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join us this morning.
Happy to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you became interested in flying.
Well, during World War II, I grew up in World War II, mm-hmm. See. I started high school in 1939. When Hitler invaded Poland, say.
Okay.
And so I lived through that, and by the time I graduated in 42, so many of my playmates, guys I went to school with, were in the service, going into service. So I had to go in, too. So I decided to fly. I didn't want to go into foxholes and whatnot, so.
You'd rather be above the action.
Yes, uh-huh.
Definitely.
Well, I was only about 130 pounds, see. I wasn't the husky kind of guy, you know, so I thought it best to fly.
All right. What was the first airplane you flew in?
I had a ride in a Piper Cub when I was going to college training detachment at Tuskegee.
Uh-huh.
But then the first airplane we really flew was a PT-19 in primary flying training.
What was that like, that very first time you were up taking control of an airplane with your flight instructor?
Well, it was great, you know. I hadn't even driven an automobile before I started flying, see. So it was great just learning. But at that age, you know, you pick up things rapidly, you know. And acrobatics was what I loved, so it was great.
What's your favorite aerobatic maneuver?
Favorite airplane? Well, P-51, of course.
Okay.
I got to fly that in Europe in 1945.
So after the primary training, what was the aircraft transition from there?
Well, you went to basic training then. In primary flying with Tuskegee Institute, we had black civilian instructors. But in basic, we had white Army instructors, and in advance after that. So,
all right. As one of the original Tuskegee Airmen, we salute your service. And, you know, you did have not only the challenge of learning to fly, but also the discrimination that was happening
in
the armed forces. And was it worse here in the country or overseas?
Oh, here. Here it was worse.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It was with you all the time. All our training was in the South, say.
Right.
You know, and it was there all the time, even on base in many cases. So.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So once you were deployed, where did you serve overseas?
Overseas in Ramazzelli Air Base in Italy. That's on the eastern coast of Italy, just below that spur on the map of Italy.
Right.
We're just below that spur, right on almost on the coast.
Can you describe a typical day that you had at Ramazzelli? What was it like to be there?
Well, I was, 19 years old then, and I just one of the guys now, and you learn the evening before when you're going to fly, and so you got up early in time for the mission, and it was great doing that. Sure. One thing was everyone drank coffee. I never drank coffee. I grew up in the household where my mother drank tea.
Okay.
So I would drink just water before I went off a mission and had breakfast. So.
Oh, cool. What aircraft were you flying at Ramazzelli?
P-51.
You were.
P-51, okay. Yes.
Already in the Mustangs. Mm-hmm. Had you flown the P-40 previously?
I flew the P-40 right after graduation and then got about 60 hours in the P-47.
Okay.
Combat training at Walterboro, South Carolina, and then overseas.
So all of your, you had 21 missions, if I recall correctly?
21 missions in World War II.
In World War II. Mm-hmm. And those were all P-51 missions?
All P-51, yes.
And bomber escort or some ground attack?
Well, it was mainly bomber escort, but we would strafe looking for targets of opportunity. And that's the only time I fired my guns on strafing missions.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I understand you you also inherited a personal aircraft from your squadron commander, and you took very good care of it, but you got a little upset one day when you picked up some ground fire.
Well, this is in Italy.
Yes.
Well, I didn't have an air. You know, the new pilots don't have airplanes.
Right.
But a fellow who had flown his missions and stayed to be an ops officer asked me one day if I wanted to fly his airplane. As long as his air, it would still be his airplane. So.
Right.
So I said yes. So I flew most of my missions in A-33 tall in the saddle, which is just great, you know. Mm-hmm.
Very good. And now, after World War II, you came back to the States and you were mustered out for a little while. But then ended up getting recalled back into the service.
I was recalled Colonel Davis had a shortage of fighter pilots at Lockbourne, and he asked us, some of us, to come back, and I did in 1948.
Okay.
And went back just about the time racial integration was taking place. Right. Well, the Air Force decided in April of 48 to integrate.
Right.
And I came back in June of 48. So I was involved in that racial integration starting in 1949.
Mm-hmm. But even though the armed forces were not segregated anymore, you still ended up having some challenges throughout the years in leading up into Korea and even post-Korea.
Well, I went to electronics school and ended up as a maintenance officer of the 19 bomb group on Guam, B-29 outfit. But as a pilot, I also checked out in the B-29s. So I qualified as a pilot flying, and I served as a co-pilot on a flight crew when the Korean War started. So, and that was, I got a new squadron commander in May of 1950 who wouldn't speak to me. He didn't go for this thing of racial integration. But I guess the 12th of July, 1950, our squadron, our crew was going on his seventh mission. Mm-hmm. And at the last minute, he replaced me on the airplane, didn't want me flying. It so happened that was the first B-29 shot down over Korea. My crew was there, and I wasn't with them. So anyway, so that happened. And it was just, he didn't want me in the squadron. But there's a follow-on to that story. Because 10 years later, I was a major, transferred to Plattsburgh, New York, and became an Armored Electronics Squadron commander. And he was my wing commander, that same officer. Okay. I served under him for a little over 2 years. And that was two of the best years of my career under him the second time. And I loved working for him the second time. He had changed, and he just made me feel good working for him. So it, it was one of those things. I was happy to see that change in an individual, you know.
And did you see that same sort of change throughout the armed services? I mean, you you didn't retire until, I believe, 1970.
The thing is, I came back from Okinawa and went to Carswell. Ended up at Carswell for a while, and I was there for some training. But they, one day I was number two on a housing list, base housing at Carswell. And they called me that afternoon and said, "Are you colored?" And they let me know I couldn't move into base housing. And because base housing was built off base because Carswell was such a small base. And I objected to that. I had several meetings with people, including with the base commander, figuring out what to do. Suddenly I found that I was headed to Limestone, Maine. And so it got me as far away as they could. But that was in March of 1953. From then on, it seemed like the racial problems just disappeared. The Air Force made the system work, I think. So from then on, those problems seemed to be behind me, and I was able to move ahead as if I was just one of the guys, you know.
Excellent. So. We're talking with Lieutenant Colonel George Hardy, one of the original Tuskegee Airmen, and not only with World War II, but a storied career, as we were talking about Korea. And then you actually finished up your career with more missions in Vietnam, flying the gunships.
A gunship in Vietnam, yeah.
What was that transition like for you?
Well, it was a little difficult. You see, I flew in Korea in B-29s. I got 45 missions over Korea. But then in the intervening years, I went to Institute of Technology twice. I got a B.S. in electrical engineering, then went to Japan and whatnot, and I ended up at Plattsburgh, New York. And I left there in 62 to go back to the Institute to get a master's in systems engineering. But also, they took me off flight status. I was off flight status for 7 years. Of course, I was in technical jobs doing procurement, systems, engineering, whatnot. But then they refurbished these C-119 airplanes and the gunships. I had hundreds of hours in the C-119. And suddenly in 1969, they called me back to the cockpit. I got a refresher course in the 119 after 7 years. Then became went to combat crew training as a crew and went overseas to Vietnam as a lieutenant colonel then. See. But when I got to Vietnam, I didn't fly with my crew. As a lieutenant colonel, the squadron was at Phan Rang, southern part of South Vietnam. But all of the airplanes were at two forward operating locations, one at Udon, Thailand, and one at Da Nang. Mm-hmm. And they made me the commander of the detachment at Udon and then later at Da Nang. So I flew 70 combat missions over there, flying at night, looking for trucks.
Wow. What a storied career. Starting in World War II, in retiring in November 1971, just a few of the medals and distinguished flying across with Valor, the Air Medal, 11 Oak Leaf Clusters, and Commendation Medal with one Oak Leaf Cluster. A very storied career, and we appreciate you being with us today. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what you're doing now with the Red Tail Rise Above and spreaining the message of the Tuskegee Airmen and trying to inspire a new generation of young people to rise above their circumstances. So we will be back with more From the Stand on EIA Radio.